The primary election is almost here. Vote centers will be open May 7th from 6 a.m. to 6 p.m. Make your vote count. Visit vote.indy.gov for more information. This message was paid for by the Marion County Election Board.
What time was it when I texted you, Eddie, and said, you know what, Pat Boylan would be a good get?
1:32 in the morning.
Were you asleep? I get a kick out of this. My sister does this a lot, like on a family text. She's like, I'm going to take Philip off this thread because he's in bed. And I'm like, he doesn't have his phone muted. Like, you don't just turn it down.
Oh, sorry. I saw it at 1:32. You texted me at 1:29.
So you saw it 3 minutes after I wake you up?
No.
Yeah, you have your phone. You're a normal person. You have your phone probably silenced, right?
Yes. No.
I do. I have it silenced.
Occasionally, Pat Boylan and Jeremiah Johnson will not their phone, but their headsets have them turn up too high during the national anthem at Pacer games. It's awkward for everybody near the scores table. It's only happened once, but I like to bring it up every time. Pat joins us now. Of course, you hear him on the Pacers radio network along with Mark Boylan and Eddie Garrison. And he also, which is why I thought in addition to talking about the playoffs, he'd be fun to have on. Pat was working for the Big Ten Network covering Indiana's spring football practice game and session. And Pat, I wanted to begin with that. Appreciate your time, but new coach for Indiana. And I heard Kurt Cignetti say, I don't know if our second team offense is that great or our second team defense is that bad, or it might've been the other way around, but your overall impressions of, I guess, coach and personnel.
Overall impression would be that Kurt Cignetti is a character. And I think people have realized that before the spring game and before that interview. He was obviously at Big Ten championship game talking about it. They were going to be there next year, and he's already been talking some smack in the IU-Purdue rivalry, so I don't think that shocks anybody. But that answer was one that really took me off guard, because he basically said, I don't know if our second-team offense is really good or our second-team defense is really bad, and I think I know the answer, hinting at, you know, maybe the second team defense not being where it needed to be. But man, he's blunt. He's clearly has a terrific resume of turning programs around. He's never had a losing season. And just the way he handles his business is one of a lot of confidence. And just kind of watching IU and preparing for them, for me, it was almost like when you cram for a test in high school. You know, I'm so ingrained here in the day-to-day with Pacers and Fever that moving over to IU football was very much like cramming for a test back 15 years ago or so. But I think they've really got weapons in place offensively and a good offensive line that I think they're going to be pretty good there. I think the question is going to be whether they can hold up defensively, and maybe Cignetti, you know, kind of alluding to that a little bit in his answer.
Pat, where should reasonable, like, I know you've only briefly seen them, but you're around all the coverage here in the city and the state, and I have a problem finding where the line should be with his good-natured, like, confidence and eagerness and just, you know, smack talk as you outline versus the reality of what IU football often is. Where should reasonable expectations be at year one, or has he already set the bar to they're going to go to a bowl game and they're going to win one?
Yeah, you know, it's a really interesting question, and it's one that I've just kind of been ping-ponging around in my head over the last few days, and one that I don't even know I have an answer to. And I'm certainly not an expert in this category. I think you guys know that. But to be honest, I love the confidence. He's clearly come in and said, we've got to come in and have a mindset change. And you'd have to maybe give him a lie detector test to know if he really thinks that he's going to be in Indianapolis at Big Ten championship game here in 7 months or however long away that is. But I think his larger point is we need our guys thinking like that. Even if we don't get there, we need that type of confidence and that type of swagger. And we had access yesterday to talk with two of the players during the game and one after the game. And two of those guys, which are transfers, which I found this interesting, the two guys that were transfers from JMU, both without me really asking the question, kind of took on that same persona of their coach, which was, you know, I kind of set them up asking questions about their play in the spring game so far, about their experience with the previous staff. And they kind of took it as, look, we're here to turn this around. We're here to punch people in the mouth. We're not here to mess around. And so I found that interesting, that clearly those guys, there are 10 guys from JMU to come over to IU. That's a JMU team that you know, would have won the Sun Belt if they were eligible to do so. And those guys clearly have that same kind of confidence. So what he did clearly worked at JMU. And then the obvious question, and previously in his career before there, by the way, the obvious question becomes, does it work at the Big Ten level where there's maybe less parity than some of the smaller conferences? We know the teams at the top are probably always going to be there, and they're going to be championship contenders, and that climb's a lot more difficult from IU's perspective. But they have so many home games this year, which I think is really helpful. And if you look at the schedule, the first half of the schedule is very doable. So when a new coach comes in, he probably would love to have a home-heavy and maybe not high difficulty strength of schedule in the first half of the season. And the schedule gods have delivered that to him. So I do think there's a good chance they get off to a good start. And then because of the home heavy schedule, that you're talking about them in the bowl picture once that comes around.
Pat, in terms of the quarterback position for Indiana, I mean, Curtis Rourke was the transfer from Ohio and obviously an older player. It was thought that he was going to be the starting quarterback. I would assume that that was the case through spring ball, and how did he look?
It was the case, and to be honest, of the two, Taven Jackson looks better, but it's tough to do an apples-to-apples comparison. Jackson's going against that second-team defense, which, as we alluded to a moment ago, Coach Cignetti not totally sure exactly what he thinks of that second-team defense just yet. I thought Taven Jackson looked like a guy that, while you know he had his challenges last year, looked comfortable, like he had been playing on that field before, like he knew what he was doing, like this was comfortable for him. And Curtis Rourke looked a little bit more of the guy that was still kind of getting ingrained to a new system and a new program. But that's very fair for a transfer, especially for a guy that's been at one school for a long time. It's a new school. It's a new program. It's a new environment. It's a new head coach. It's a new offense. So there's a lot more for him to get adjusted to. That said, his production speaks for itself. And, you know, for those of us that went to Ball State or those that watched the MAC closely, I think it's become obvious in the last 10 or 15 years that those very top quarterbacks that do tend to find their way in the MAC. When I was there, it was Keith Wenning. A little bit before, it was Nate Davis. But there are obvious other examples from other MAC programs. The couple here just come to mind. Those guys very obviously are capable of competing at a Big Ten level. I actually had the thought, you know, it's a good thing the transfer portal wasn't around back when I was at Ball State, because I don't want to speak for Keith Wenning, but Keith Wenning maybe ends up at IU if something like that happens. So Curtis was the MAC's best offensive player last year. He has 3-4 years of terrific play under his belt, and I see no reason why that won't translate, assuming he stays the starter. I expect him to be that and to be productive right away for IU. And they've got an O-line that, if you ask any of the coaches, the O-line's the first thing they point to, what they think of is their biggest strength. And then if you ask the coaches their second biggest strength, they go to the wide receiving core. So I think that bodes well for them as well. It was maybe a little bit of a shaky debut, but it's tough to put too much weight into spring ball.
Keith Wenning was going to transfer to Indiana in 2014, but didn't want to change his name to Keith Losing, so he just went ahead and stayed where he was.
You said it, not me.
Hey, Pat. In terms of the Pacers and Bucks, Pat Boylan, our guest, in addition to the duties that he had in covering football for the Big Ten Network, of course, on the sidelines for the Pacers Radio Network, a big one against the Bucks. We've talked a lot about it. In your opinion, the storyline of this series, aside from Giannis's health, that maybe is going a little bit untalked about because of so much focus on Giannis, from Indiana's standpoint, would be what?
I don't know if it's going necessarily untalked about or under discussed, but I still think at the end of the day, as you referenced there, what you just said is the most significant and overpowering storyline and has the biggest chance to change the dynamics of this series. To me, the second far and away biggest storyline that has the chance to do that is the level of play that the Pacers get from Tyrese Halliburton. This is a guy that, when the Pacers won 4 of their 5 games against Milwaukee last year, was playing, frankly, in those games, and for a lot of that portion, like a borderline MVP candidate. We know his story. We know he suffered the hamstring injury. He came back, went through a little bit of a struggle. But when he ended the season, he wasn't quite at that level, but he's been producing at a much higher level. And I think this week is pretty fascinating from this standpoint. When he went down, he came back, and then it was pretty much go, go, go. And then there was the All-Star break. But he didn't really have an All-Star break. He was part of the skills competition. He was part of the All-Star game itself. He was essentially the MC for this city. He had so many events and so many things that he took part in, which was great, but he didn't really get that typical All-Star break rest. So I have a hunch here that this week has been really good for him. It's the first time he's gotten more than just a day, or maybe he had one like 2-day stretch in there, but he really hasn't had anything like this since maybe the early portion of the season. And don't forget, this is a guy that played for Team USA as well. So he's really been nonstop since back late summer, in fact. And I think if the Pacers get close to that version of Tyrese Halliburton, you put Pascal Siakam in the mix and a potential stretch without Giannis, the Pacers are in a really good position. But every time I look at a playoff series, the first thing I do myself is I look at the stars, I look at their availability, and I look at how they're playing lately, and that's obvious for Milwaukee. But I think the Pacers are as well equipped from a star standpoint as they've been in a very long time with Halliburton and Siakam. And so how good is that version of Tyrese Halliburton, I think, is one of the most important dynamics you'll see at play here in this series.
Pat Boylan of the Pacers Radio Network is our guest. Pat, there was a small little video package on ESPN highlighting the young rising blood that's in the NBA right now. Anthony Edwards, they highlight both Chet Holmgren and Shai Gilgeous-Alexander out in Oklahoma City, and Tyrese Halliburton involved in that package. From a star power standpoint, what type of opportunity is at play exclusively for Tyrese Halliburton to once again remind the world that he is a star on the rise?
Yeah, and I think that's what it is. It's a reminder because I think he put himself on the spotlight during that in-season tournament run. That in-season tournament run in November, and that got the Pacers all the way to this championship game against the Lakers. You know, he took down some really high-profile teams, especially once they got to the knockout stage. Everybody remembers the big shot he hit against Boston. And then they went to Vegas, and he took down the Milwaukee Bucks with terrific play and a late closing kick there. And then went all the way to the championship game against the Lakers. And that was kind of his moment where I think he became a household name, at least among sports fans. I think he's somebody that you talk to an NBA fan and they don't about him, of course. But for the casual sports fan, I think Tyrese Halliburton became a household name during that run. So I don't think that's what this is about. I think he's already there. But it's a reminder of, oh, yeah, this is what this guy is capable of. And this is what, when he's at the top of his game, he can do for a team in terms of lifting them. You know, this series to me is maybe the most up in the air of all of the series, especially with Giannis's availability. And so a stretch of play that Lillard has, or that Halliburton has, or that Siakam has, if any one of those three guys is able to elevate their game to other heights that even their high levels are not used to, I think it has the massive chance to really change the implications of all of this. So from Halliburton's perspective, I think he got his star, if you will, nationally during that in-season tournament run. And I think now it's kind of a reminder of this is how good he can be. This is how important a player like he can be to a team. And when you see him at the top of his game, you know, his numbers early January were about 25 points, 12 plus assists per game. And those were per game averages. You're talking about a guy leading the league in assists. You're talking about a guy scoring 25 a game. You're talking about a guy at the time close to 50, 40, 90, and just how far that elevated this franchise. The Pacers went from not in the play-in tournament last year to in the top six this year, in large part because of him. So, yeah, I think it's another really big stage for him, and I think if you're a Pacers fan, you should be optimistic by how he handled the stage in the in-season tournament.
He is Pat Boylan of the Pacers Radio Network. Pacers-Bucks, Game 1. You can hear him on these very airwaves. Tip-off time, 7 o'clock. Pre-game shortly before that. Pat, always appreciate you making the time for us, and enjoy this, man. It's great that the Pacers back in the playoffs.
Gentlemen, appreciate it very much, and we're looking forward to hopefully having a packed...
Life is so much more than a diagnosis. It's about sharing time with those you love, hanging with friends who lift you up, and experiencing all those moments that bring you joy. All hits, no skips. Learn more about Kisqali Ribociclib 200 milligrams at KISQALI.com and talk to your doctor to see if Kisqali is right for you. So long live singing to the oldies, jamming out to something new, and everything in between.
Fieldhouse here, Pacers.com/tickets is where fans can purchase their playoff tickets. Appreciate the time here this afternoon.
Appreciate it, Pat. Widely regarded as the worst song of the 80s. Did you know that?
No, I did not.
Yep.
Now, they got a traffic report in the middle of the song, which is pretty awesome, right? Shout out to our boy Matt Baird across the hall. Joining us now, and I don't think he's got to study traffic patterns between here and Milwaukee. My guess is he's flying. Chris Denari is the television voice of the Indiana Pacers. Pacers Bucks game one Sunday up in Milwaukee. Chris, how are you?
Hey, I'm doing great. Jake, how are you?
Good. Driving or flying to Milwaukee?
Oh, I'll be flying. I'll be flying with the team tomorrow afternoon.
And that's like a 35-minute flight, right?
Yeah, can't be very long. we fly. Team will practice tomorrow. And then get on a flight, and yeah, it's probably 35, 40 minutes.
Do you get the impression at all, Chris, that and it sounds weird to say layoff, because, you know, but a week between games, which when you're into the grind of the NBA season, are you ever curious how a team may respond from that? Do you get the feeling that the guys are kind of like, let's get this going by now?
Well, I just had a conversation with Ben Shepherd for Pacers Weekly tomorrow, and I asked him about that, and they took yesterday off. They've been able to sort of choreograph their practices the way they wanted. And the good news is it's the same for Milwaukee. It's not like you're, playing one of the play-in survivors, the 7 or 8 seed, where they're coming in having played a game or two. So Milwaukee's a little bit in the same boat. But, yeah, I think this group is ready to go. But I think at the same point, it is such a long season. You're on the road. The Pacers, really the back half of the season, played the majority of their games on the road. So I think it's been good to be home and good to be in the practice facility and, you know, pay attention to detail and those types of things. But as Rick Carlisle just said, he goes, hey, once the ball goes up, you know, anything can happen. So but I think this team is in a good mindset. I look at it, Jake and Jimmy. I mean, they won 47 games. I mean, that's 12 better than last year. They secured a number 6 seed, did not have to go through the play-in tournament. But I also think this is a very hungry team that wants to prove something in the postseason. And Rick Carlisle always says, he goes, yeah, the past is important, but we have to look forward. And so even though you were 4-1 against the Bucks during the regular season, this is a brand new season, and it's the postseason.
TV voice of the Indiana Pacers, Chris Denari, is our guest. Chris, you've covered many a playoff series, many the beginning of a playoff run, and we talked to T.J. McConnell earlier this week, and he highlighted that for players, it doesn't always feel like there's that big a difference in playoff basketball. If you can play, you can play. Sure, there's nuance changes and the pace slows down, but if you're a real baller out there, you're going to be fine. As you look back to the media availability earlier this week, what is the overall vibes, the overall mentality, especially of the younger players that are getting to taste this for the first time?
Well, I think the good news is they've got some people they can rely on. I mean, you have a couple of Pacers, or three, McDermott, McConnell, and Turner, who have all played in the playoffs with the Pacers. You've got a guy in Pascal Siakam who's won at the highest level. He's played, nearly 70 games in the postseason and won a championship in Toronto. And then you've got some guys, Jalen Smith played briefly some playoff games in New York, in Phoenix, Obi Toppin in New York, and Aaron Nesmith in Boston. So they understand what it's like, even though their role is not what it is now. So I think the guys who have not played, and one of those is Tyrese Halliburton, be able to lean on some of the veterans and what they've experienced in the postseason. I also think, going back to November, December, the in-season tournament experience for this team, I think, will pay dividends, because those were like playoff games. The environments were a little more special than maybe just a regular season game. And so I think they can pull from that as they look forward to what's going to happen in the next week or so.
When you look at it, Chris, and I've asked this question a lot, maybe even to you and others, but if you look over, let's say, since the Siakam acquisition, because things changed once Buddy Hield was gone, and that's no longer applicable, that roster. But since Pascal Siakam came here, the Pacers have played as how many teams? You get what I'm saying? In other words, in terms of style or approach to a game plan, they are capable of being how many different teams over the course of a playoff series? Does that make sense, what I'm asking?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think one of the things, I was looking at some of the Milwaukee numbers. Now, remember, Pascal did not play any games with the Pacers against Milwaukee, and none of the games were coached by Doc Rivers. And so all of a sudden, those things are different. I looked at the Pacers. They did not shoot the three very well at all. I think 30% in the five games against Milwaukee, and they still won four of those. But yet they averaged well over 125 points per game in all those games against Milwaukee. So I think the one thing that they've done, Jake, is as the season progressed, they got better defensively. And a lot of that came with Siakam. He led the team in rebounds. He gives the Pacers a little bit more size. And while their offense may not have been number one, they were still probably top five or six. And the defense, which was 28th, 29th, 30th, all of a sudden was down around 20th. And so I think those are significant numbers that the Pacers, you know, figured out that they can win and play in different games. They don't have to hit 18 threes to win. They won a game where they were 5-for-35 from three-point range against Milwaukee earlier in the year. So I think that's the good news, guys, is that the script can be different. It does not have to be one way for this team to win. I think they can win multiple ways, and I think they proved that during the year against Milwaukee.
Chris, this might seem odd to say, but because he is an unquestioned leader on this team and it's been a minute since they've been a part of the postseason, he was certainly a different player since the last time that they were in the playoffs back in the bubble. But how important does this series feel for this version of Miles Turner?
Well, I think it's, as you said, it's a much different role for Miles than he had back in the bubble. You know, that was a situation where Domantas Sabonis was still on the team, even though he really didn't play. And I just think Miles is in a great space. He really enjoys his role on this team, what Tyrese Haliburton has meant to him. And I think, you know, what Pascal Siakam has brought to the table for Miles Turner. So I think he's in a really good space, had a really good year, 17.7 rebounds. I thought late in the year shot the three very, very well. You know what he can do from a shot blocking standpoint. And so I expect really good things out of Miles in this postseason.
You know, Pascal Siakam, one of the things, aside from Chris Denari, our guest, the television voice of the Pacers, aside from the experience and just the overall skill set of Pascal Siakam, right? The fact that he's been through these rigors are critically important, I would think, to this roster. But Chris, do you think he's been like involved enough with this team to be able to be vocal? Like, do they turn to him now, and do they know him well enough for him to be able to speak up, if you will, about what they're about to enter into?
No question. I do believe that. In the conversation I just had with Ben Shepherd, and again, he's a rookie that will experience playoff basketball for the first time. I asked him that question. He said, absolutely. Is Pascal's been very good with us as a group, as well as those of us individually that have never participated in the playoffs. So I absolutely think so, Jake. I mean, he's gotten very comfortable in his role. He's played 40-plus games now after coming over in January. Has really enjoyed the environment that he's in. And I think, you know, the way Rick Carlisle operates, it's the way he coaches his team. When you come to a practice, it's not just Rick's voice you hear. It's all of his assistant coaches. And I think with this team, even though you've got guys that have been here a few years and Haliburton and, of course, Miles Turner that's been here for nine, I think Pascal has felt very comfortable with his role and with his voice. And I know his teammates listen to him.
Pacers TV voice Chris Denari joins us. Chris, I've mentioned this a couple of times this week, and it's at no fault to Milwaukee, more of a fault to Portland. But without Giannis, this feels like a team that is probably one of the best collection of supporting cast that Damian Lillard has ever played with in his career, outside of maybe some of those teams with CJ McConnell, to the point that overall sentiment there, they're still a very talented team. And one area in particular is what Bobby Portis has been able to do over the last two, three, four games in this run for them to secure their seeding. How do you think the Pacers deal with Portis compared to how they did in the regular season?
Yeah, I mean, Portis is definitely a very talented player, hard-nosed, tough, can shoot the three. I mean, there's a reason why I think he's a favored son in Milwaukee. I mean, they love him. When when he's come off the bench and he checks in for the first time, Fiserv for him goes crazy. And, you know, without Giannis and not knowing what his availability is going to be, it makes his role even more crucial. And so you've got to be aware of him, no question. And this will be, I think, just based on, you know, what happened in the regular season, it'll be an emotional series. I don't want to say there's no love lost between the teams, but I think this is a Bucks team that has won a title. They've got a coach in Doc Rivers who has won a title, and they're trying to prove that they are still one of the best in the Eastern Conference. And you have, I think, the Pacers, an up-and-coming young team that knows its future can be bright, but you have to look at the now. And that's what Rick Carlisle said today. We're hungry, and we want to prove something. And so I think that's going to make for a fascinating series. And I think nationally, I think a lot of people are looking at it as one of the more fascinating series in the first round.
You know, Chris, we were talking with a couple of people this week, TJ McConnell being one of them. When I asked TJ McConnell, like, hey, give me a couple of X factors, right? We love to talk about X factors. And he said, well, I think guys that are really important to our team that don't get headlines are Andrew Nembhard and Aaron Nesmith. Very hard to argue that. Obviously, TJ McConnell would know, right? He's in the front line. Do you think that we're at the point now where, like, say, a Milwaukee knows that? And I know that on the surface that sounds crazy because it's NBA, Jake. Of course, they analyze everything. But do you think that the role that those two are capable of playing, do you think that they are – it is widely considered by opponent to know just how valuable those two guys are?
Well, I think especially as you get into the playoffs, Jake, I mean, you narrow everything down to matchups. It's not like the regular season where you have a game on Tuesday, then you might have a back-to-back on Wednesday, and then you've got a third different opponent on Friday, and then Monday you've got somebody else, and you may not have all the time in the world to pay attention to every, you know, little aspect of the opposing team that you're playing. I think in the playoffs, it's front and center. They are drilling down on everybody that the Pacers have. And so I think as you analyze and look at how valuable Nesmith and Nembhard are, especially on the defensive side, it'll be very important for Milwaukee to pay attention to them. And those are also two very good three-point shooters. I mean, Nesmith for the better part of the year was a top five three-point shooter in the league until going into a little bit of an end-of-a-season slump. And Andrew Nembhard is very capable of hitting two or three threes in the course of the game. So I think Doc Rivers and his staff will know what they're dealing with when they're looking at Nembhard and Nesmith.
Chris, what sense do you get in terms of the amplified importance that has been put on getting a game of one of the first two games, rather, of getting one of the first two games in the likelihood that Giannis misses those first two? The idea of the Pacers getting out in front in this series, where do you view or where are your thoughts on the fact that it feels like, at least from our seats, that there's been amplified importance to steal a game when Giannis is not out there?
Yeah, it feels like that. Just, as Rick Carlisle said, there's a lot of noise out there, and it can be positive noise and negative noise based on your team and what you're dealing with. I tend to believe it's good, honestly, that you're on the road first, because you would feel even more pressure, I think, if you had home court advantage and you didn't have Giannis on the floor in game one or game two. I think the fact that you're on the road and you have the chance to steal a game or two, I think plays a little bit more into Indiana's favor. But I look at it this way. I've seen so many games over the years, whether they be a playoff game or a regular season game, where X team doesn't have their top player and you have other players that utilize the moment to step up and play very well. So I have to believe, you know, based on Milwaukee and so many veterans that they have. I mean, I was just doing the math. I think they have almost 700 games of playoff experience, and the Pacers are less than 200, and most of those come from Pascal Siakam and Miles Turner. So they have a lot of playoff experience among all those guys on their team, even without Giannis. And they'll be able to, deal with that, I think. But, it's again, I think if the Pacers were at home, without Giannis, I think you'd feel a lot more pressure than you feel when you're on the road against the Bucks.
Is this team more mature than its number of games?
I think so. I've always been impressed in my 2 years now being around Tyrese Halliburton. He does not seem like your typical 24-year-old in the way he carries himself and the way he leads and the way he is not shy about having his voice heard among his teammates. And so I do think this team is a lot more mature and a lot more prepared, even though they have far less experience in the playoffs than Milwaukee.
Chris, from your seat, do we see the same high level, full pedal to the metal tenacity this Pacers offense is capable of, or do you expect it to inherently take some step back because of the way that the playoffs so often see pace dwindle?
Yeah, maybe a little bit, but that's going to be Milwaukee's decision. They're not going to want to run. And I think it'll be incumbent on the Pacers to get out and play the way that they want to play. And we've seen that not just with the starting group, but when TJ McConnell comes in with that second unit, he's a guy that can really push the pace. So I think that will be Indiana in the driver's seat, trying to make sure that they're playing at the pace that they want to play. I think Milwaukee will definitely try to make it more of a half-court game. They're not a team that runs a lot anyway. They don't rely on fast break points. But I think Indiana does not want to stray too far away from the way that they played during the course of the year.
Now, Chris, have we already game planned on who's in four because you're going to be doing the Eastern Conference Finals?
Well, here's the deal. We can only do the first round. So
gotcha. Okay.
Once the first round is over, basketball, as far as play-by-play for Bally Sports and Chris Denari, is done. So I will be, I'm hoping the Pacers are in the postseason that far, and we've got Racers and Pacers, but it's all national after the first round.
Yeah, I need you in turn four because you don't get angry when I carry it too long and drop it to you too late, and others might, and then I'm in trouble, right?
Yeah, I think so. I'm a good teammate, Jake. I just sort of roll with it. If you get... You know, usually it's at the wing and the wheels, but sometimes they're making that turn in four, and that's fine. I can deal with that.
And as I've mentioned to you on the air many times before, Chris, give me at least this much credit. At least 20% of the time, I do have the courtesy to get on the intercom and go, my bad, Chris.
Oh, absolutely. No, that is absolutely true. Jake is the first to say, my bad. I'll do better next time.
But 20% of the time, I say that. Chris, we'll be watching, and certainly it's exciting, man. This is the best time of year when the weather breaks and we're out of the darkness of winter and playoff basketball. It should be being played in Indianapolis, and it's going to be for games 3 and 4. But first, the task at hand, Sunday, game 1, Pacers and Bucks. Enjoy it and appreciate the time. We'll talk to you soon.
Hey, thanks, guys. We're thrilled to have it. We've got games 1 through 4 on Bally Sports, and we'll see what happens. But looking forward to it on Sunday.
All right. Again, Chris Denari, the television voice of the Indiana Pacers.
Life is so much more than a diagnosis. It's about sharing time with those you love, hanging with friends who lift you up, and experiencing all those moments that bring you joy. All hits, no skips. Learn more about Kisqali Ribociclib 200 milligrams at KISQALI.com and talk to your doctor to see if Kisqali is right for you. So long live singing to the oldies, jamming out to something new, and everything in between.
Kevin Bowen joins us now. Kevin, Chris Ballard talked for approximately how long earlier today?
20, 25 maybe. Yeah, I think probably just over 20 if I had to guess.
Anything he said that when he said, you know, every once in a while, and we know this all too well recently, every once in a while during a press conference, something is said where people just kind of look at each other like, man, I didn't expect to hear that. Was there anything that jumped out at you in this particular installment of a Chris Ballard presser?
Yeah, probably a couple things. I would say we knew he was like really a big fan of this wide receiver draft class. I think he's also equally as big a fan or pretty close to as big a fan of the offensive line in this year's draft class. And, you know, when he's asked about Anthony Richardson in some of these settings, or certainly today, you know, it was, you know, protecting him as kind of the first mention, which, you know, if you just look at the roster, if you look at how the offensive line played last year, I don't think you would consider that to be a huge, huge need. So I'll be really curious to see if and when or how they go about addressing that if they want to come the draft. You know, if you want to go with best player available, then I don't know. I mean, theoretically, that their board's going to have a lot of that. I always find it interesting this time of year, you know, he asked me, okay, how many players have first-round grades in the draft? And he said 19 to 21. Well, when you look at that and they're drafting at 15, you know, if all of a sudden the first 14 picks happen and 14 of their first-round guys go in those first 14 picks, then, you know, you're sitting there and you want to trade back and you only want to trade back a couple spots, you could still collect some picks and then still get a guy they have graded first round. So, yeah, I would say those were probably a couple of the items that stood out to me. I don't know, probably some others will pop into my head.
Did you feel like, and I'm going by the Cliff Notes that you had posted out, Kevin, because, you know, we were on the air, obviously, as you were wrapping that up, but sounded like Ballard was, there were two areas that you had mentioned that I found intriguing. One, did he mention edge again? Because that's an area that I know that he's consistently tried to hit on. And you and I have talked about the fact that, you know, they got some players there that are guys. I don't know that they're breakthrough guys. And did it sound like he was more open to getting toys for Anthony Richardson?
Yeah, edge-wise, he did not mention that specifically. And I've always kind of looked at that as, you know, their pursuit of Danielle Hunter. I kind of look at that more as the love or the whatever infatuation with Hunter as a player and less about the need overall. More like, wow, here's an opportunity. Great. If not, we don't look at the position as like we have to get something in the building. Again, I probably am – I'm definitely, you know, a person that thinks edge rush, you have to continue to try and find a speed guy there to, you know, diversify that room. What was the other question?
In terms of offensive weapons for Anthony Richardson.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yes, he did mention that. Now, again, when talks and asked specifically about Richardson, it was much more of a protect first, and then, you know, get into the playmakers, get into, you know, some of the weapons, and, you know, we'd like to add guys, and, you know, yards after catches is something he talked about with us at the combine, and that was something that he brought up again. I would say the other thing that stood out to me, going back to your first question, Jake, was, you know, I wanted to ask him, you know, if you go back to the end of the season, you know, he kind of fell on the sword for Gus Bradley and the defense. You know, each of the last two seasons, they've ranked 28th in points allowed. Why does he think that is the case? And again, he kind of fell on it and saying, yeah, you know, I probably didn't give Gus enough, which, you know, obviously he feels that way and said it. And then all of a sudden you've gone through the first month of the offseason and you haven't done a single thing defensively. You know, everything has just been re-signing of their own. They've not added anybody. And, you know, Ballard has probably been one that is the most vocal whenever the draft happens to, you know, throw that caution flag up and say, all right, yeah, so we've drafted these rookies, but, you know, expecting instant impact from them would be, you know, probably is the most likely of situations to occur. So his answer to that was, you know, he really feels like the secondary was very young last year. The cornerback room especially was very young. And it just feels like the growth from year one to year two for a lot of those guys will be substantial. He also compared it to the offensive line position a couple years ago, where the year they went 4-12 or whatever it was, 4-12-1, you know, the offensive line, he felt like actually played decent late in the season, and he thought there would be a bounce back there. And he was certainly right. I mean, they bounced back, I would say, in a pretty big way this past season. Where I would disagree with him, though, is there's actually a track record of the offensive line doing that. You know, Quentin Nelson and Ryan Kelly and Braden Smith especially, they have had, you know, history prior to that 2022 season of playing really high-level football, Pro Bowl-caliber football, whereas outside of Kenny Moore, you know, nobody in the secondary has skipped that or done that. And, again, just a lot more youth and, you know, not even as much, I guess, draft pick investment when you look at where Nelson was drafted or Kelly was drafted or even Braden Smith. So that would probably be one where I appreciate the explanation, but I would disagree with him.
Kevin Bowen is our guest. You hear him weekdays, 7 to 10 a.m. on these airwaves on the Wake Up Call with KB and Andy. Of course, you can follow him on Twitter, at KBowen 1070 and 107.5thefan.com is where you'll find all his work in the lead up to Colts draft 6 days from now. I know we mentioned out of the gate, Kevin, but the 19 to 21 first round grades that Chris Ballard had mentioned and alluded to, does that level itself of being, the way I read that, first tell me if I'm right or wrong on this, that means, let's go the high number, there's 21 first round grades, he would view 11 of the 32 picks as reaches, right? As second round players that are first round because they can't be taken anywhere else. Picks have to be made. Is that right?
Right. Correct. Yep.
So with that, in terms of your view of this draft class and what is there, does that speak more towards his belief in the depth that is going to be present at multiple positions in this draft? Or does that speak more to Ballard is identifying it as a weaker first round than maybe we initially perceived?
I wouldn't say that last part necessarily. He feels like it's an extremely good offensive draft at the top and made it clear that, like, I don't, you know, this is me explaining Ballard's words. Ballard is like, I don't think it's a super weak defensive draft class. I just think it's especially strong offensively. And again, I think if you look at any mock draft out there, there's some serious question of, like, you know, does the first defensive player not go till 7, 8, 9? Like, you know, we can maybe get through the first 10 picks and only see one or two defensive guys drafted. And again, you know, probably none in the top five. So I think that kind of falls right in line with that. Again, I'll go back to wideout and O-line. I mean, those are the two position groups that he feels like there's great high-end talent and there's great depth. And that's where I think it makes kind of gauging those positions difficult. Do you think that there's great high-end talent there, so you want to tap into that because maybe there's not that at other positions, or do you want to rely on the depth because, you know, maybe a third-round wideout in this year's draft class could be a first-round guy in some other years? You know, part of me thinks kind of this is how wideout's going to be pretty annually now moving forward, just with how much the NFL game, or I should say how much the college game and hell, even the high school game started to trend this way, but certainly the college game is so much pass happy. So, depth-wise, I think, again, wideout, O-line especially.
KB, do you look at what could fall to the Colts? And when you see Brock Bowers potentially there, I don't think he's going to be ultimately. I feel like somebody is going to view him as too good to pass up at 10 or 12. But we had Dane Brugler on. You had Dane Brugler on as well in the previous weeks. And he keeps talking about Dane Brugler almost to try to educate, or he keeps talking about Brock Bowers almost to educate people to say, look, don't just pigeonhole him because it says TE by his name. He's a pass catching weapon. Do you think that would check both box for Ballard, knowing that, yes, he might be a tight end, but it would help alleviate the development overall of Anthony Richardson? It might not be a high-end wideout, but it is a high-end pass catcher that could be available there for you.
Yeah, I think it's a great question. It's probably one I've kind of gone back and forth on with myself a lot and just not having a great grasp of how Ballard really feels about his tight end room. And then again, to your point, the uniqueness of a guy like Bowers. I mean, if I'm Chris Ballard, I just look at Shane Steichen and say, tell me how you would utilize him and, you know, walk me through this. What does it look like? And if it looks like anything we saw at Georgia, I mean, how would he not be worthy of the 15th overall pick, in my opinion? And the thing about Bowers, too, is he's a pretty good blocker. And so, you know, that's something I thought always made Jack Doyle a unique player, is that you trusted him in both the run and the pass game. And that's not something you typically say about, you know, every tight end out there. And again, Bowers is even, you know, he's a much more explosive than Doyle if the college game translates to the professional game at that level. You know, he led college football in yards after catch from this past season for tight ends. I mean, that's a stat that really stands out to me. So, yeah, to me, Bowers would be worthy of it. To your point, it is just kind of a weapon and not necessarily labeling him as that TE. And again, would really give that room a bona fide number one guy. And right now, I think it's a room of a bunch of twos and threes.
Kevin Bowen is our guest. As Jimmy mentioned, of course, he is on the Wake Up Call with KB and Andy 7 until 10 each morning on this radio station. Kevin, do you think realistically, and I've gone back and forth in my mind on this a lot, I know that Ballard says that, you know, like they have a really good idea that Richardson has the talent to kind of elevate everybody around him. Do you think deep down, if truth serum is in them, that they 100% have seen enough to know that? Or is there, and that's not a knock on Richardson, but that do you think Richardson has seen every kind of look that a quarterback can see so that we can definitively know who he is?
No, no, no chance. I mean, there is certainly projecting from the Colts in that. I mean, hell, the guy played, what, a quarter on the road all year? Didn't play a team a second time. You know, didn't have a ton of, you know, the two-minute red zone, you know, fourth quarter type of moments. Not really red zone, more the two-minute kind of fourth quarter stuff. You're projecting him. I mean, hell, he's got, what, 170 snaps. Again, the more snaps you have, the more, you know, opposing teams have tape, and now they might counter with, okay, we tried this, that's not working, let's now, you know, counter to that. Or, you know, if and when he really has a poor, poor game, obviously teams will want to replicate, you know, what that defense did to him. So, yeah, I think the belief in him is less about, like, he's been in every situation, every scenario. It's that when he was on the field, we really liked what we saw, and now we just believe with even more reps and even more practice time and just natural maturation that he'll handle all of that other stuff really, really well. And I think that other stuff of just not experiencing it, I mean, it's like the Pacers come Sunday night. I mean, obviously, the expectations for them given Giannis's injury, like, I think a lot of people feel like they should win the series. But still, just in terms of, like, experiencing what a playoff basketball game is all about, they need that. Like, Halliburton needs that, and so many of those guys in the roster need that. And again, that's what I think, you know, one of the biggest bummers for Richardson's rookie season is, you know, he didn't get the feeling of what the Week 18 win or go home was all about. And certainly C.J. Stroud got it, and C.J. Stroud delivered. I mean, hell, even some of the Will Levis moments late in the season of just, you know, kind of feeling some of that for Tennessee, the big comeback they had in Miami on Monday Night Football, you know, those sorts of things you just missed out on. It's definitely not he experienced it. It's much more to do with the, you know, we felt good about the sample size and we're projecting a little bit.
How many games for Pacers Bucks, Kevin?
How many games does Giannis play?
Well, that's a good question. I'll say he plays
4.
Well, I mean, we don't know how many games it goes, right? Let's say that he returns in game 2.
Wow. That's a little earlier than I would guess. If he returns in game 2, I'm kind of torn on Pacers in 6, Bucks in 7, if you were going to give me that. Assuming Giannis, like, was his normal self in game 2.
Right, and that's the other big question, right? It's how long does it take to get kind of back on the horse?
Right, and I mean, that right there, let's just play out the hypothetical that you just laid out. Like, if he's back in game 2, are we talking 42-point average that Giannis had in the 5 games against the Pacers, or are you trimming that to 28 or 30? And because that's, I mean, I think if both teams are fully healthy, I think a lot of people view it even still as kind of a coin flip series. Well, in a coin flip series, if you take the star player for each team and Halliburton falls into this category and you just trim their, you know, whatever, their extreme high level just a little bit, and now all of a sudden Giannis, whatever, cut his points down by a few. Is he living at the foul line as much as he usually does? Is he able to play the amount of minutes that he usually does, which is always amaze me. And then on the reverse of that, you know, okay, Siakam is, you know, the guy guarding him. Does he get worn down a little bit more from having to guard Giannis? But maybe if Giannis is not as his full self, does that allow Siakam to do a little bit more on the offensive end of the floor? So, I mean, for so many reasons, there's just a domino effect off of Giannis' injury. So, you know, based off these reports in 2 to 4 weeks and all of that, I've kind of said he won't be there for at least the first 2, maybe games 3 and 4. So, yeah, I went Pacers 5, Pacers 6.
The Fan Zone, Kevin Bowen is our guest. Again, you hear him 7 to 10 a.m. on these very airwaves, the wake-up call with KB and Andy. KB, we won't talk to you again until the outlook shifts towards what the Colts are going to do in rounds 2 through 7. So you still have time on your program to modify this and change it. But for our sake and our listeners' sake, as you look at everything that's happened, what Chris Ballard said today, the mocks that you've done, the mock drafts that you've consumed, scouting reports you've looked at, what ultimately do you think is most likely to happen for the Colts? Do you think they make the pick, or do you think they move in some capacity, be it forwards or backwards in the draft?
Yeah, I think it's going off of Ballard precedent. In an ideal Ballard draft, he would move back to 20 or 21. He'd get an additional probably late second rounder. And then, you know, if you go off his 19 to 21 first round grades that he mentioned today, you would still draft a first round graded player. And then you would have a late second, you know, early third. I don't know exactly what the draft trade formula would look like. But I think something to keep in mind, too, is, you know, the Colts walk into this year's draft with 7 picks. They have their exact selection in all 7 rounds. So right in the smack dab of the middle of each of those rounds, that's it. And for Ballard, that is really a much smaller number than he is used to. He's typically operated a lot closer to 10, 11, you know, even I think he's at a 12 draft pick class, if I'm not mistaken. Now, of course, you can get into what the approach should be. Should the approach be more darts at the dartboard? Ballard would say historical data shows you that's the route to take. Counter to that would say, well, at some point you should probably start to change up some things, and or, you know, do you feel like you've been so team run it back? It's not like you need to fill a ton of areas on your roster right now. Do you opt for a little bit more high end and, you know, maybe even package some of those picks and trade up? So you walk out of the draft, you know, with not as many guys, but again, maybe you're getting a little bit more of a high end guy. So yeah, I just think going off of past precedent, it would be the, you know, trade back method, get the additional pick. But at the same time, if you look at the roster as a whole right now, you know, and based off who else coming back, there's not a lot of like obvious open starting jobs either. So, you know, should you opt for a little bit more of a, no, let's not play the quantity game. Let's play maybe more of the quality game.
Kevin, here's my bold prediction on who the Colts are going to draft. You ready?
Yeah.
So you've studied this a lot more. I mean, I shouldn't say a lot more than have I, but like in terms of the Colts kind of reading the tea leaves of what they may or may not do. And I get that Ballard loves the trenches, and I know that Bowers is going to be tempting if he's there. I don't think he's going to be, right? Brian Thomas, wide receiver, LSU. That's the guy that I'm going with. Your thoughts?
Yeah, I don't think that's crazy at all. I did my mock draft, and I debated him or ended up going with Terrion Arnold out of Bama. But
yeah, if he's there Thomas too, that's going to really tempt them, right? Those two probably would tempt more than Thomas, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's size, it's speed of Thomas. That's certainly exactly something that Ballard would covet. It would quite the wake-up call to Alec Pierce. Probably not what Alec Pierce wants if you're heading into Thursday night. But, again, it goes back to the wide receiver question. Very, you know, high-end talent, according to Ballard, and great depth. So how do you view it? Do you view it as you tap into the top of it, or do you think, no, there's Deebo Samuels, there's DK Metcalf, there's, you know, Terry McLaurin, there's, you know, guys drafted outside of round one that can turn out to be really good players at that position for you. I think that's what kind of makes that fascinating. But, yeah, I mean, I would say that sort of debate or that player in that general range, that would definitely make some sense.
Life is so much more than a diagnosis. It's about sharing time with those you love, hanging with friends who lift you up, and experiencing all those moments that bring you joy. All hits, no skips. Learn more about Kisqali Ribociclib 200 milligrams at KISQALI.com and talk to your doctor to see if Kisqali is right for you. So long live singing to the oldies, jamming out to something new, and everything in between.
Kevin, where do you see the Pacers, Bucks in terms of the first two games? Do you think the Pacers get game one or get game two? Because with Giannis likely off the board, I'm with you. I think he doesn't come back till game three. You have to get one. Like, I can't overstate that enough. You have to get one of those first two with Giannis off the board. Where do you think it happens? And are you like Jake? Do you have a preference on where it happens? Because he doesn't want them to win game one. He wants it to be game two.
Well, I would disagree with that. I would rather them win game one because I think that...
Nope, then you get swept in five.
Gentlemen sweep.
Yeah, I just think that puts more pressure on Giannis thinking he needs to play in game two. And then if he rushes that back, that is no injury to rush back. And again, if he is just at a, and I'm just throwing random numbers out here, but if he's 75% for game two, if he waits till game three, he might be 85. Again, when you're talking coin flips in this series, that could be the difference in a singular game. So I think the earlier you get a win, the more you get a restless fan base and a restless city and a restless organization, it seems like right now, you just ratchet up all of the soap opera-ness to it all. And so the earlier you get a win, the better, not only for the lack of health for Giannis, but right now there's just drama with the Bucks. And we had their radio analyst on earlier today, and he said it's easily the least confident that the general feeling has been in their six-year run that they've had here. So I just think they're a bit on the ropes. And I honestly am curious what the atmosphere will be like. I think you'll have the general playoff feel to it early, but if you kind of punch them in the mouth early, hell, if you win a game, you know, you're going to start to get, I think, just some uneasiness to the overall environment. So, yeah, I would definitely say game one.
Yeah, you know, Kevin, it's kind of like I said the other day, we were talking to someone, and if you go back to, like, the teams where the Pacers first broke through in the NBA and the Reggie years and the Pacers, Knicks, and Racers, and, you know, and Pacers and all of that, and then they had the year where Reggie had the eye injury and they went in against Atlanta in the playoffs, and the attitude, like, civically was kind of like, yeah, they'll be okay next year, but they're a little dinged up, and let's just kind of go through the motions. Then we'll come back next year, and it'll be like – and it kind of feels like Bucks fans might feel that way right now, doesn't it? Like, where there's just – it's not necessarily the title-chasing Bucks, but you kind of hope that they are vulnerable, if that makes sense.
Yeah, and I would think the big worry that probably differs from, like, that exact Reggie comp is, like, we're in a day and age where the star can leave at the snap of a finger. And I'm not saying Giannis is there, but, like, there are certainly – I mean, you fired your coach midseason when they were, like, the second-best team in the East.
I know.
I mean, they made this Lillard trade. I mean, they didn't do that after losing 4-1 as a one seed last year, and we all saw the failure clip from Giannis. They didn't do that to be at home on May 1st. So I just think for the future of Giannis's era in Milwaukee, there's, like, legitimate questions, concern about all of that as well. So there's already a big old boulder on the back of the Bucks. If you can put another boulder on them by Sunday at 9:30, I think that would do wonders. And honestly, that's a big reason why I think Pacers in five is really, really realistic.
Game one Sunday will be the Pacers and the Bucks, and then the first talk about it on Monday at 7 a.m. will be the wake-up call with KB and Andy, with Kevin Bowen and Andy Sweeney. Kevin, appreciate it. Enjoy the weekend, all right?
Jake, I meant to ask, and not to do it because I know you guys are up against it, but I guess I'm doing it. Remind me again, why do people view Long Beach as, like, the second most coveted, anticipated, however you want to describe it, IndyCar race of the year?
Great question, and the reality is this. In IndyCar racing, you have three racing formats. You have ovals, which is obviously what the Indy 500 is, road courses, which are permanent fixtures, and then street courses, which are temporary courses utilizing city streets. Long Beach is the most historic of the street courses. Road course would probably be Watkins Glen, although now that Watkins Glen's no longer on the schedule, you would probably say Road America is up there. But Long Beach has a very rich history in being a civic party on the West Coast that is a showcase for the automobile in the Los Angeles area, and it is so coveted by the fans there. It is a massive party. There will be just absolutely packed stands, bleachers, people in the, you know, running along the streets, and then it goes right along the ocean itself on Seaside throughout Long Beach. So the combination of history, local enthusiasm, and drivers, great drivers that have won it, because Little Al's won a bunch there, Michael Andretti's won a bunch there, etc. It's great. I love it. It is literally awesome.
Thank you for the education. That sounds enticing. It's something to visit at some point.
It is, absolutely. I tell people all the time, Kevin, you know, people ask me, like, man, we want to go to another race besides Indy. Long Beach is the one to go to because the weather's perfect. Yeah. I mean, everything about it's great. And, I mean, the number of famous cemeteries within driving distance also makes it very desirable. So there's a lot going on.
Yeah, I think that would be a pool of one person that would be interested in that.
Well, they've also got a great bar in Long Beach that Frank Sinatra used to frequent and that has PBR on draft. So PBR party in Long Beach. There you go.
Say no more. I'm there.
All right. Kevin, enjoy it.